The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's a very effective tool, and I think it's part of a pattern where President Trump and his allies they're very good at messaging. So the term deep state to me is it just sounds, you know, dangerous and haunting and inherently abusive. You know, it's part of the Trumpian lexicon. It's very similar to me to sort of, Trump is using the term to discredit officials who question, you know, Trump's talking points on North Korea, let's say, or, you know, somehow undermine him. And so, you know, he does this repeatedly. With Robert Mueller investigations, he labeled it a witch hunt. With the media, he uses, you know, fake news. So deep state to me, which started out with just the FBI and the CIA, has now grown.
I'm David Preece, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 14th, 2020. In a 2018 poll, 74% of Americans said they believed that some group of unelected government and military officials was definitely or probably secretly manipulating or directing national policy. What is the actual history of presidents and Congress clashing with national security and law enforcement institutions? And how has that led to Trump's notion of a deep state out to get him? I spoke in the virtual jungle studio with two-time Pulitzer Prize winner David Rode of The New Yorker, who has turned his attention to this tricky topic in the new book, In Deep, The FBI, The CIA, and The Truth About America's Deep State. We talked about intelligence, law enforcement, inspectors general, public trust in government, and of course, Bill Barr. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 14th. David Rode on the supposed deep state. All right, David, you have reported about and written about and received Pulitzer Prizes for your work on the Srebrenica case in the Bosnia War, and the post-9/11 conflict and terrorism in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So why turn now to what is, at its very core, a story about the national security and law enforcement bureaucracy?
Because I met many members of the national security and law enforcement bureaucracy in years of reporting in Bosnia and Afghanistan and other places overseas. I also had a large misadventure at one point when I was kidnapped by the Taliban a decade ago now.
I think misadventure is an understatement, David.
Well, it's true. It was a mistake, to state the obvious. And, you know, was held there for 7 months, able to escape with the help of, you know, this Afghan journalist who was kidnapped with me. So I've stopped covering wars. I'm very happily married, the father of two young daughters, and you know, this is a natural progression to me after working with diplomats and intelligence officials and law enforcement officials, you know, in foreign countries to, you know, look at them and their work here in the U.S.
So before we get to the content of your work, I've got to ask, does it bother you personally when people talk about the FBI, the CIA, the national security bureaucrats of the United States in some of the same terms that they seem to use for the terrorists and extremists who did things like kidnap you?
We live in an extraordinary time of extraordinary division. I do think that the United States has incredibly powerful intelligence agencies. I do think, we'll talk about this in depth, that there needs to be aggressive oversight of these agencies by every branch of the government, the president, Congress, and the courts. And I think there should be more transparency about what the CIA and the FBI are doing, and that lets journalists, muck around and create problems and, write stories that infuriate, I'm sure, folks who work in the intelligence and law enforcement communities. It is an exaggeration, though, when people, talk about, coups and call FBI agents, human scum. Right. Luckily, we've avoided that, level of abuse and violence, in this country. But I guess I want to, at the same time, I respect and acknowledge the fear the American public has of abuses by intelligence agencies.
Sure. So the phrase deep state was originally used to describe Turkey's military primarily, which did actively intervene in government and undermine political leaders and do the kinds of things that the national security and law enforcement agencies are accused of trying to do. And of course, others referred to it for the Egyptian military as well, which blocked democratic reforms. But what is the deep state to those in the Trumpist camp? But even in different terms, what is the deep state to liberals and to non-Trumpist conservatives across the decades?
It's fascinating because I found that it is a relatively new term in the U.S., as you mentioned. And then there's a deep division about, what liberals see it as and what conservatives see it as. The term that liberals use is the military-industrial complex. They fear, a cabal of generals mm-hmm. and large defense firms that lead the country in endless wars. President Eisenhower famously warned of it. And then I'd say conservatives today talk more about the administrative state. And they see a relentlessly growing sort of federal bureaucracy that's ceaselessly interfering in people's lives and impinging on, Americans' basic rights and freedom. So across the board, there was a Monmouth University poll in 2018 that found that 70% of Americans believe that unelected officials and generals have undue influence on policy in Washington. So it's across the board. But it's a very different threat depending on whether you're talking to liberals or conservatives.
You narrow it down largely in your narrative here to the FBI and the CIA. But as you mentioned, the deep state in some of these narratives talk about the wider administrative state and about the regulatory authorities that exceed what was meant by mere implementation of laws. So why not address the wider bureaucracy of the 9 to 10 million people somehow employed by the federal government, or as in Turkey, professors and the intelligentsia? What's the benefit and the drawback of focusing solely on that national security and law enforcement segment of the federal government?
In part, I feared taking on too much, frankly. And I think there's, a special fear and special powers that the intelligence and law enforcement communities has that interested me. I think in the digital age, surveillance is a very, very sort of urgent issue for Americans. And I did have this sort of past experience interacting with members of the community, the national security community. So I felt a little more comfortable. I completely agree with you that there's the same issues exist if we're talking about a, EPA worker. Or a national parks worker. Like it's, do we need permanent kind of career government officials? Can they be apolitical? And who should, oversee them? It's the same question, whether you're talking about the CDC, or the CIA.
Mm-hmm. You tell your story largely through the eyes and the reflections of a small set of characters, with people who have experience back in government to the 1960s, like Jim Clapper, and others who are much more recent, like Will Hurd. But one of these people, of course, Bill Barr, I'll return to later, so let's put him aside for now. But among the other characters are people like Rich Blee of CIA, Tom O'Connor, Joan Dempsey, Jim Baker. Why did you choose to highlight this story kind of through the experience over the decades of people who lived and worked inside the agencies and departments?
I wanted to bring to life the deep state, this term, which we'll talk about more. I don't really like the term. It's sort of political rhetoric to me, but I think there is a permanent government. There are people who spend their careers working in the intelligence community or in the FBI and the Justice Department. And I wanted to kind of introduce them to readers and introduce the system that is supposed to prevent them from committing abuses. And that's why I kind of ended up with these characters. Look, mm-hmm. I will be honest. You and I talked when I was sort of thinking of putting in the book proposal about this. Mm-hmm. I had a very difficult time getting people to talk to me. People in the intelligence and law enforcement community are very nervous about talking now. I had people explicitly, people who had left were worried about having their security clearance pulled that would prevent them from, continuing to work in a post-government private sector job. People don't make much in the government, as you know. And so anyway, I was glad for the few who talked to me for readers, but I was also struck by how people were being silenced.
And did you find that these people you talked to, including those people I just listed, who were the basically on the record characters in the story, did you find that any of them bought into the full idea of the deep state, or did they more often agree with the need for oversight and agree with the need for political and judiciary branch control of some activities of the national security state?
I found, and of course, the ones who are going to talk to me are going to say they like the system. And it's funny speaking to you and many, your listeners who I would assume worked in many of these agencies. I have a big concern about looking too credulous in this book. My characters do generally agree that there should be oversight. Richard Blee, who's one of the first people I talked to this book, who I knew from his work overseas for the CIA, his complaint was, we did agree to oversight. We all were really worried, and, we can talk about the history, but, he said mm-hmm. the CIA was, horrified when the Church Committee happened and the Church Committee reforms were enacted and the Senate and House Intelligence Committees were created. But, they've learned to live with that system. And yeah, my main characters, starting with Rich Blee, said there is a rules of the road now. We obey them. We don't want to do something that one president tells us and then have it declared illegal by the next president and possibly go to jail. So the theme I heard from Blee and others was that it's the political class that's mm-hmm. violating the rules of the road that were agreed to back in the 70s after the church reforms.
Right. Let's touch on a bit of that history before we get to the heart of your book, which is the more recent invocations of the deep state narrative. So you tell the story of the church and less so the Pike committees in the 1970s and the roots of the institutions to prevent abuses by national security and law enforcement that came after that. Talk just a little bit about how successful you think those committees were at, in a sense, bringing about a new era of relationship between the legislative and executive branches and the reforms in the late 70s and early 80s that resulted.
I think they were enormously successful. And I'm probably being generous to them, but in this day and age, to look back at a largely bipartisan investigation led by Senator Frank Church of Idaho, John Tower was a ranking Republican that, unearthed, decades of abuses and problematic behavior by the CIA and the FBI, some with the approval of presidents, some without. And the raft of reforms that were made were, extraordinary. I mentioned the Congressional Intelligence Committees. The FISA court was created to have a system where judges would approve surveillance as part of national security investigations. The FBI director was limited to a 10-year term. Independent counsels were created. This is slightly off topic, but again, it's this idea of looking into abuses in the executive branch. Iran-Contra was an example of something that was investigated by an independent counsel. Just greater transparency in their work. These committees had subpoena power. And so, you know, it wasn't perfect. I think many members of the intelligence community felt the church community went too far and vilified them too much. You know, there's a semblance, you know this yourself, but a sense that, you know, elected leaders are happy to try intelligence operations when they might solve a thorny foreign problem. But when the operation goes wrong, the intelligence agencies are then sort of hung out to dry by elected officials. So, and my goal was to say to readers, we've had crises of confidence in our government, in our intelligence agencies. An earlier generation with the church reforms addressed it and came up with reforms that created public confidence that the CIA and FBI were under control and serving the American people. And we can and should try to do that again.
Yeah, it's an interesting development, both the public confidence, but frankly, also confidence on the part of intelligence and law enforcement. I mean, I didn't start at CIA until the 1990s. And if something had occurred more than 6 months before I started, it was irrelevant to my work because the institution was there. And certainly by then, the institution was there that congressional oversight was, it wasn't even seen as legitimate. It was just seen as a natural part of the work that, of course, we went to brief Congress regularly about all kinds of things. And I didn't know at that time, only learned later, just how much we did brief Congress on the most highly sensitive covert actions there were. But I think there is a part of that institutionally that makes sense from a bureaucratic protection point of view, which is we're going to inform you about all these things we're doing, perhaps as a check to make sure that we aren't going too far in pursuit of the values we share, but also because now you own a piece of it. And if something goes wrong, we can at least say back to you, so why are you so adamant about this now when we had briefed you on it earlier and all you said was, what do you need from us to make this happen?
Yep. No, and one of the reforms, again, and I credit President Ford and President Carter for doing this together, was covert action findings, right? That sure. There were now written documents that would describe every covert program that the president had to sign, and then copies of it were given, you know, to the leaders in the House and the Senate, including of the, you know, intelligence committees. But many Americans don't believe any of this. You know, they don't believe me. I'm a mainstream journalist and maybe too close to the national security officials, current and former, like you. And I wanted, you know, the people to see the breadth of these reforms. They haven't all, you know, fared well over time, but it's, you know, it was a way to use an attempt to use the history of the 40 years to show, you know, we have a system. Here's what's worked in terms of controlling the CIA and the FBI, and here's what hasn't worked.
And it is interesting as you develop this through the 80s, 90s, and into the presidencies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama, how it ebbs and flows a bit and how the oversight seems to be part of the pattern, but at times it pushes one way or another. And then some truly exceptional cases. We'll fast forward to a case that most people don't talk about much anymore, but it truly was exceptional when an American citizen was executed by the president with no public court proceeding and no public presentation of evidence at all. This was, of course, the case of Anwar al-Awlaki. Now, that doesn't really fit the deep state narrative because it was not a rogue intelligence agency doing this on its own accord. This was the president of the United States asserting the right to do this. But it certainly does feed into that overall impression, perhaps from Congress, perhaps from the public, of, wait a minute, so we have oversight, but we can still have cases like this that just seem off to us. How did that play into this for you?
Well, one of the successes of the church reforms is that I think there was and I'm truncating a huge amount of history here, but particularly in the case of the FBI, there were things that J. Edgar Hoover did before the church reforms that presidents didn't know about. Since the church reforms, presidents control the FBI and the CIA, I think, effectively. You don't have a rogue FBI operation or rogue CIA operations. And I think that's a big success. But now what you just said, this is a case of President Obama, you know, executing an American citizen with no public process, no presentation of evidence at all in drone strikes. You know, that was seen as necessary by the American public in the wake of 9/11. But it does show the strength, you know, of the presidency. And some argue, one of the, we'll talk about this more, but one of the, you know, one of the alliances in Congress today is between, you know, Senator Rand Paul, the Libertarian of Kentucky, and Senator Ron Wyden, a liberal Democrat from Oregon. And those drone strikes really alarmed them. They feel that Congress has failed and is not aggressive enough in its oversight of the intelligence community, particularly after 9/11, and that President Bush and President Obama, you know, used, you know, these agencies improperly, and Congress should have been fighting this, fighting torture, fighting surveillance, fighting drone strikes. So I do think congressional oversight has been weaker since 9/11.
Mm-hmm. You also balance that, of course, by pointing out that during the 1990s in particular, that oversight and investigatory powers could actually dilute the impact of investigations if they're not used carefully. And I think you even extend that a bit to the Benghazi hearings, which you point out were rather extensive. And I think many people have forgotten, you know, just how much of an aberration they were, with the various Benghazi investigations dragging on longer than the inquiries into the attack on Pearl Harbor or the Kennedy assassination or even the 9/11 terrorist attacks. What is that balance? Because on the one side, clearly you've developed this idea that robust and almost even intrusive oversight is necessary and is good for the nation. On the other hand, you point out, but when it goes too far, it's actually counterproductive.
You got me.
What is that happy middle point?
You totally got me here. Like I
like this Goldilocks problem. Yeah. Not too much, not too little, but right in that perfect happy zone in the middle.
And you know, there's all these incentives. Like it's to me, and like it's, you know, it's great that there's, you know, firebrand ambitious young politicians on the Intelligence Committee who are bringing up Benghazi. Like they're going to make their name by, you know, having a big investigation and bring down a, you know, president of the opposite party. There's young journalists who are going to break stories that, you know, make their names. But there is a pattern where soon, you know, right after Watergate, investigations are bipartisan, they're serious, they're, you know, but as they go over time, you know, there is, you know, this use of committees and hearings. I mean, it's always been political. Everything is inherently political in Congress. That's fine. That's part of the legislative branch. But there is a sense that it becomes politicized investigation, that you know, whoever the sitting president is, whether it's Henry Waxman attacking contracting in Iraq under George W. Bush, or the Benghazi investigations under Obama, that it's the investigations are just being held to score points. And then the biggest case of all would be the Clinton impeachment, which essentially backfired on Republicans. We'll see if the Trump investigation backfires on Democrats in November. But there is a happy medium, and there's a warning, and it was interesting, you know, we can talk about Will Hurd, about he felt that Democrats had overplayed their hand on these investigations, and that the Ukraine investigation, you know, it was reckless behavior by the president, but not, you know, enough to remove him from office. So yeah, it's a cautionary note to Congress that all this noise, you know, has less of an impact with the public if you're just constantly declaring your political opponent a massively corrupt, you know, murderer. Mm-hmm. And Benghazi, you know, I covered Benghazi. It was a terrible tragedy. There was not adequate security in place, but, you know, there was no evidence of Hillary Clinton, you know, personally ordering Ambassador Stevens and other Americans murdered. You know, that was a conspiracy theory that was not true.
Does it strike you as interesting that, you know, as we're recording this, we're perhaps in the middle of, perhaps coming off the peak of, it's hard to tell with this news cycle, the story of potential Russian bounties on the heads of American soldiers in Afghanistan and the lack of a response from the executive branch, at least at the level of the White House, for any strategic reaction to that. If that also resulted in three or more deaths, which is uncertain at this time, to be clear, the reaction to the Benghazi attacks versus the reaction to these deaths, which perhaps there was some intelligence warning of quite some time ago, does the difference in the reactions from Congress tell you more about the counterreaction to the Benghazi overreaction? Or does it tell you more about the simple hyperpartisanship and perhaps the Trumpification of the Congress right now?
I think it's the hyperpartisanship. It's a failure in the news media, in that there's been a change since the 70s in terms of an explosion of outlets and a business model collapsing and the economic profitability of, Fox being far to the right and MSNBC, being far to the left. That's a very profitable thing. So I think the system isn't great, but I think there's a broader hyperpartisanship in society that emerges. And the second half of the book, a lot of the Trump era, examines that, like the trafficking in conspiracy theories for political gain. I think pre-existing distrust and division has sort of been exacerbated by the rise of the internet and cable TV news and hyperpartisanship. So I don't want to just blame politicians for this atmosphere.
Sure. The heart of the book is, of course, about this moment and about Trump and his allies' scapegoating of the national security and law enforcement bureaucracy, picking up on these themes that, as you've noted, our natural need for oversight and concern about potential abuses within law enforcement and intelligence. How much do you think this has been a conscious strategy? Because you note in several cases that the president himself seems to pick up on something, amplify it, and then it's almost as if there's some intellectualization done post hoc to try to put this into the wider theme of, see, this is what we've always told you about the deep state. What's your take on this? Do you think that this is a conscious movement and part of a larger plan, or is this just political convenience driven from the top?
I can't get into the mind of Donald Trump. My sense after talking with sort of current and former officials in his administration is that he is deeply distrustful of people in general. He's a product of the New York real estate world. He grew up in a field where everyone was sort of exaggerating and spinning and trying to gain a little bit of advantage. And so he thinks that that government employees aren't nonpartisan. He thinks government employees, this is according to his aides, work harder for certain presidents that they like, and then they slow roll ideas from presidents that they dislike. He thinks that reporters aren't trying to write like the most unbiased story they can. He thinks reporters are writing the stories that kind of hype things in the way that help the reporter advance their own career. So I think he believes this. I think he believes there are bureaucrats who are stopping him. I also think he doesn't have a good understanding of the government and the mechanisms that are in place to stop this from happening. And then lastly, though, I think he also massively exaggerates for political gain. I know every president has sort of complained about the bureaucracy. Reagan said the State Department was being too soft on communism and wouldn't carry out his policies. Obama felt Pentagon generals were releasing troop increased numbers for Afghanistan as a way to box him into sending more troops than he wanted. But no president has, claimed that a coup is occurring.
Right.
And so whatever Trump believes or fears, I criticize in the book the way he's peddled so many conspiracy theories.
Yeah, let's look at one example of that. Trump claimed soon after taking office, Obama had wiretapped his phone. And I'm wondering how critical you see that as for, in a sense, encouraging and energizing his followers and even some reluctant allies to latch onto this bigger deep state narrative.
It's a very effective tool. And I think it's part of a pattern where President Trump and his allies they're very good at messaging. So the term deep state to me is it just sounds, dangerous and haunting and inherently abusive. It's part of the Trumpian lexicon. It's very similar to me to sort of Trump he's using the term to discredit officials who question, Trump's talking points on North Korea, let's say, or, somehow undermine him. And so he does this repeatedly. With Robert Mueller investigations, he labeled it a witch hunt. With the media, he uses, fake news. So deep state to me, which started out with just the FBI and the CIA, has now grown. Pentagon, when Trump wanted to pardon soldiers accused of war crimes, and generals challenged, you know, the president's call for that. He declared the Pentagon part of the deep state. And then most recently, not Trump himself, but Trump supporters have declared, you know, Dr. Deborah Birx and Dr. Tony Fauci members of the deep state. And so it's a rhetorical device. It's political rhetoric that he uses to discredit sources of power and information that threaten him.
And that in turn led to, and perhaps was fed somewhat by this tension that former civil servants or career military officers faced in this era. On the one hand, while in active duty service, you salute the commander in chief and say, yes, sir, unless it's an illegal order. And policy differences don't matter unless you're a policy appointee of the president. And at that level, you can argue for a policy decision with the president. And even then, once the president decides, the ethic is you say, I'm on board, sir, and you follow it, or you resign in protest. Those are your options. But for retired military and intelligence officers, here you have a president talking about hoaxes here, talking about all of these things that in many cases are objectively not true. And they feel the need to speak out after, in some cases, a 40 or 50 year career to say, no, American public, this is what you're hearing about what intelligence is, but that is not what it is. And I can tell you because I've been there across presidents of both parties. So when people like Jim Clapper or John Brennan or Michael Morell speak out, on the one hand, you point out that they make the deep state narrative more plausible because here you have people who are only talking about these things because they were once part of that bureaucracy. But on the other hand, they're retired, they're American citizens, and they can speak out on policy and from a position of more experience and more information than many pundits. Where does that balance lie? Because that's a really tough one in an open, engaged democracy.
It's true. It's a strange thing. And this gets into journalists. Like if, you know, when I'm covering, you know, national security as a beat, I'm supposed to write news stories that are, you know, down the middle and fair and fact-based. But if I become a columnist, I'm expressing opinions. I had current, you know, and you're in touch with more current intelligence officials probably than I am, but I had current kind of intelligence and FBI officials say that they felt that the comments, the Comey in particular, kind of urging people to vote against Trump. That's Jim Comey's right as an American citizen. That's totally true. But current officials did complain to me that they felt it was playing into the Trump's conspiracy theory. I guess I would say that, like, you know, former intelligence officials and journalists have a right to speak, but should maybe think of the impact on their, like, professions as a whole, you know, when they do and how they, you know, I don't know, express themselves, that it can be used against, you know, members of their profession who are still in it, you know, to accuse them of bias.
It's an inherently tough question because it applies to journalism too, which is to the extent that journalists step up and fight for other journalists who are using unnamed sources and say, that's our business. They're feeding this narrative about, well, you don't really care about this issue. No, it's an inherent tension when trying to get at the truth about issues and call things like you see them, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's about the craft. I mean, you know, these former officials know how the FBI goes about an investigation. You know what it takes to get something in a presidential daily brief, and so they're very knowledgeable. But I would say, like, being openly partisan is different, and calling for people to vote against a certain president is a very serious step for a journalist or a former law enforcement official to take. And then lastly, you know, in terms of the pandemic, you know, there is a need, you know, I call it, there's a, you know, you can call it, forget the deep state. I think the deep state is, again, a charged term that makes you dislike these officials and distrust them. You know, on the other side, you can talk about public servants and good government, you know, and maybe that's too generous, too, like, liberal or pro-government. There's a permanent government. I use the term institutional government. You know, I think we need people who work for certain institutions for their careers that have expertise. And I think those people need to be nonpartisan. I think, you know, Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci are an example of that. The pandemic shows us that we need to agree on basic facts. You know, we need someone providing basic facts that we trust, who's not just, you know, partisan. so we can agree on the policies we need to undertake together to protect ourselves from Absolutely. Pandemics to economic recessions to national security threats. So I think that lastly, that like career civil servants, if they are given an order by a duly elected president and the mm-hmm. order is legal and ethical, they should obey that president. I don't right. agree that folks should have been undermining Donald Trump secretly if they disagree with his policy. Leave the government if you want, but the democratic mandate lies with the elected leader. That's sure. a core function of our democracy, and this book may be, you know, more convinced of that than ever.
And one of the great ironies here, of course, David, is that through modern history, and even in this administration, some of the, perhaps most of the people who are leaking and telling stories about how unfit, in this case, they say the president is, are his own appointees. These are not members of the deep state, people who have been, you know, GS-12s in one of the national security bureaucracies who are largely keeping their head down and doing their work. But it's the people who the president himself hired, put into a position, and then left and said, I can't believe what I'm seeing. It's almost like the shallow state is the one that is doing a lot of the things that the deep state is being blamed for.
Yes. And let me just say the kind of core conclusion of the book is there is no deep state in the conspiratorial way that Donald Trump uses the term. Sure. And, right. you know, again, we have powerful government agencies. We should, you know, oversee them aggressively and zealously. And they make mistakes. And there was mistakes in the Trump-Russia investigation. The surveillance of Carter Page shouldn't have lasted as long as it did. But, you know, there is no secret cabal of CIA and FBI officials who, you know, plotted to remove Donald Trump from office. He made many mistakes of his own that, you know, increased his political problems. But I just, it's very important to me that Americans yeah. understand that that is not true.
Right. And yet there's one person in a position of power other than the president who does seem to believe quite a bit of that narrative. And he does play a key role in your book. And you have, you cite things going back to the 1970s when he said things that certainly led to this openness to the narrative. And that, of course, is Bill Barr, who has a role with advising a CIA director in the 70s regarding oversight, who has a role in the Bush 41 administration when he's talking about the use of executive power. You've written a lot about Bill Barr and gotten to know the way he thinks and the evolution of his thinking better than almost anyone. Talk to me a little bit about how you think he has both fed into this evil deep state narrative, but also in a sense used it to push forward some of his strong executive power views in this administration.
I think Bill Barr sincerely believes that the United States needs a strong presidency, an executive branch that is more powerful in certain ways than Congress and the judiciary. He said this himself in a speech to the Federalist Society last fall. You know, he said that if you look at American history, the branch that saves the country when it faces existential threats, the Great Depression, wars, the Civil War, it's the president that acts decisively. I mean, the president has the legal authority and the, you know, obviously the departments of the government to do things. And he says and he believes that the church reforms and other post-Watergate reforms, the War Powers Act, you know, the oversight mechanisms I talked about, independent councils, he thinks, are unconstitutional and an infringement on a president's power. Mm-hmm. And he complained that, you know, decisions from judges on the West Coast trying to throw out the president's travel ban, you know, early in the new administration were improper. You know, he thinks the impeachment and many of the oversight efforts by Congress are simply partisan investigations designed to slow down the administration. And he really believes that, you know, a president should run the executive branch as needed, that the only way that president can obstruct justice is sort of suborning perjury from a witness or destroying evidence. Mm-hmm. And that nothing Trump did that Mueller unearthed, you know, in Barr's mind approached obstruction of justice. That's a very extreme viewpoint. But I just want to be fair to Bill Barr in that I think he believes this. It's not he likes Donald Trump and wants to just please him. He thinks that defending the presidency, you know, is a way to aid the country and protect the country.
Mm-hmm. And in doing so, enabling those who may actually be farther down that deep state narrative than he himself is. I mean, after all, he has been in and out of government for some 30, 40 years, not deep state himself, perhaps, but certainly more involved in it than the Steve Bannons and Steve Millers of the world. So do you think, in a sense, he's opening up some boxes for the sake of executive strength and executive authority that would have an effect that even he might not like the implications of?
This is harder for me to answer. Barr did not speak to me for my book. I'd love to speak with him. I spoke to friends and people who work closely with him. I think he's not concerned about that. He's not concerned about others. He feels that the Trump-Russia investigation was improper. He is, you know, convinced that John Durham is going to find illegal activity. He thinks Michael Flynn was victimized and should have been prosecuted. He sincerely believes that Roger Stone's sentence was excessive. This is, again, an out-of-control and overzealous independent counsel investigation leading to, you know, he called it one of the worst abuses of, I'm using the wrong terms, but one of the worst, you know, abuses of, you know, justice, you know, in our lifetimes. And so he thinks the president has been treated unfairly. He himself said, you know, use the term, the need when the, after the killing of George Floyd, for law enforcement to dominate the streets. So I think that he is a tough law and order, tough pro-presidential power figure. And that's, he hasn't changed a bit over the decades.
Yeah. Well, after looking at the whole history and after tracing these people's experiences through the bureaucracy, as you've said, you come to the conclusion that there is not some deep, dark, conspiratorial, all-powerful deep state. And yet, you do call for some reform. You say there are some things that do need some adjustments. One of them is the FISA process and the FISA court. One of them is that tension we discussed between oversight that's effective and oversight that is counterproductive. What do you think are the top priorities for reform to correct some of the things that the post-Church and Pike Committee consensus didn't get quite right and make those corrections without setting the seeds down for more damage to this relationship?
Yeah, I think the work by the DOJ Inspector General Michael Horowitz has shown a giant problem with the FISA process at the FBI itself. You know, it's my job to be factual as a reporter. You know, the fact that a FBI lawyer, as part of the FISA application process to surveil Carter Page, you know, changed the meaning of an email. You know, and as I understand it, the original email said that Carter Page was telling the CIA about his meetings with Igor Sechin and Russian officials. And this lawyer reversed the meeting and said that, you know, Page was not telling the CIA about these meetings or not cooperating. And that's extraordinary. I kind of agree with Horowitz's findings that, based on what I know, that there was justification to initially surveil Page, but it went on longer than it should have. And that shows, you know, and then the broader review he's done now shows systemic problems. I mean, if there's that many mistakes in such a sensitive surveillance application, what is happening for the surveillance application, you know, to a mosque in Jersey City? And I'm a journalist and I'm biased, but more transparency needs to go into the way the FISA court works. Mm-hmm. The book recounts how a FISA court judge, James Baker, you know, then at DOJ, you know, was a character in the book, informs the FISA court judge that warrantless mass surveillance is being carried out by the Bush administration after 9/11. And the FISA court judge says it's sort of fine. That's a shocking result, at least, you know, to me. And you'd want to see more aggressive oversight from the judges on that court. So, you know, that's a easy place to start. And I agree with one of Bill Barr's proposals, which is that any kind of criminal investigation of a political campaign, you know, should have a higher basis of evidence. The problem is that the amount of evidence needed was reduced after 9/11 so that the FBI could investigate anybody they needed very quickly to protect the country. I totally agree that that needs to be reformed. But again, my broader finding is that there is not, you know, intentional, you know, politically motivated plots going on inside the CIA and FBI. But and lastly, I would urge the FBI and CIA to try to be more transparent themselves. There is going to be inherent suspicion of intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies in any country. And I think one of the lessons that I found was that over secrecy, everything being classified, you know, backfires. I think there's a huge problem with overclassification of information, and transparency to Congress and transparency to the public will aid these agencies in the long term in terms of increasing public trust.
And there's a great case study of that going on right now, where most former directors of the intelligence agencies will tell you that as much as it was a pain to prepare for and work with the analysts to generate unclassified intelligence judgments, they thought that the annual worldwide threat briefing, the open testimony to the intelligence committees with the unclassified but consistent with the classified judgments of the intelligence community about worldwide threats, was valuable, that it was a worthwhile investment for Congress and the American people. But of course, this year, the Congress has not scheduled it, and the administration has supposedly resisted it. And that seems like a step backward for what you're saying in terms of something that had been institutionalized for more than two decades actually being walked back and being less transparent than before.
It is shocking and alarming that 4 months before the president faces re-election, you know, the leaders of the intelligence community, the leader of the FBI as well, have not testified before Congress, you know, about the biggest threats faced to the country. And I've, you know, told privately that is because they fear contradicting the president. Right. Dan Coats, as I mentioned earlier, you know, contradicted the president regarding the likelihood of North Korea agreeing to a nuclear deal, and he was ridiculed and publicly attacked. The president is successfully silencing current officials and preventing them from speaking out in public. To be fair, the officials, they, you know, they think reporters are going to ask them, you know, questions designed to get them to contradict Trump. Right. They think Democrats are going to ask them. But that's part of the job. And I think Dan Coats did an extraordinary job as DNI protecting the institution and speaking truth to the American people. You now have John Ratcliffe, a partisan congressman from Texas, who, you know, is a complete Trump supporter as the director of national intelligence. Donald Trump is successfully taking over and politicizing the intelligence and law enforcement community. He's got that with Bill Barr at the Justice Department. He has that with John Ratcliffe at DNI. I think Gina Haspel and Chris Wray have resisted pressures to act politically, but, you know, he is succeeding and he will continue to succeed. And I just don't want people to downplay the seriousness of what's happening here or see Trump as bumbling. This is extraordinary that these folks haven't testified this year.
Let me close by getting your thoughts on just how deep-seated this nefarious deep state narrative may be. And in fact, could it actually be just a projection of something that's much darker and deeper itself? You've pointed out that in the Eisenhower administration, roughly three quarters of people in polls said that they trusted the federal government to do the right thing most of the time. But post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, this started declining until in the Obama years, the same question asked about, do you trust the federal government to do the right thing most of the time, was getting only around 20%, and even less than that now, between 15 and 20%. When that faith in the government to do the right thing is the underlying condition, isn't some kind of belief in an evil deep state almost a necessary next step for people to believe in?
It is, and it's a convenient and incredibly dangerous political narrative. But again, I didn't find it, and I worry that as we continue on this kind of relentless cycle of conspiracy theory and distrust and division and disdain, you know, we can't function as a democracy. The pandemic, again, is the best example. Most Republicans think that the official death count, you know, is exaggerated, that not that many people are dying of coronavirus. And most liberals, according to opinion polls, think that the official government death count is under what it should really be. If we can't agree on, you know, whether or not we need to wear face masks, you know, we're in dire straits, I think, as a society and as a democracy. So my usual ending on these interviews is to urge Americans to kind of be skeptical about government officials and government agencies. That's their right. But don't be cynical about their motives. But I would urge, you know, I don't, you know, exactly who the listeners are, but I would urge current and former government officials the same thing, to, you know, be skeptical of politicians and the public. And that, I know there's a tendency to not want to be transparent and to, you know, keep things private because they could be exploited unfairly against you, you know, by politicians. But, you know, this is not just Donald Trump and his presidency. You know, Americans don't trust the mainstream media. They don't trust the intelligence agencies. It's a wake-up call for all of us to look at how we perform our jobs, how we address the public, you know, how we respect the public. And I think to double down on core traditions of nonpartisanship, you know, faithfulness to fact, and trying to do our level best to present the reality of what's happening, and to not get drawn into the partisanship that's so dominant in these difficult times.
That's a great way to close. Thank you, David, for your reporting, for your packaging of so much about the deep state narrative, and for sharing your insights with us here.
Thank you so much, David, for having me on the podcast.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to share the podcast, rate the podcast, and visit the Lawfare store for merchandise. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha Howell. Zachary Frank is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.